millions of historical items housed in national collections were, until recently, simply gathering dust, unlike published works, which fall out of copyright 70 years after the death of the creator. Unpublished works remained under copyright in perpetuity, but recent changes to that law mean that many a piece of Australian history has been given a new lease of life. Captain Cook's recipe for carrot marmalade, Henry Lawson's private correspondence and letters and diaries written by soldiers, wartime posters, company records, just some of the myriad items that have been, until now, languishing away from view. Now, to discuss the successful culmination of the campaign undertaken by our librarians and archivists and what these changes might mean for our history and culture, we're joined by Jessica Coates. Jessica's the policy advisor with the Australian Library's Copyright Committee in Canberra. Jessie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Philip.
The cultural windfall as a result of the new copyright laws, and you've been agitating for years now. Why did the issue so galvanise our librarians and archivists?
Well, because it seemed like more of an oversight than a deliberate thing. When we were writing the Copyright Act, 50 years ago, it's actually the anniversary last year, there was probably some thought put into it, but by this stage, we'd got to the point where pretty much everybody was comfortable with the idea that most materials should fall into the public domain and be reusable, but just nobody had got around to it. And it puts a huge cost burdens on libraries and archives, plus it just stops them from being able to do their jobs. So they just decide to make it a priority.
It has to be said that usually librarians aren't that bolshy.
You would be surprised if you hung out with more librarians. But I have to say, you have to have something pretty wrong when you've got the librarians revolting.
No librarian is ever revolting. I have great admiration for their ilk. Now, the copyright laws cover unknown authors or orphaned works. Would you please explain those terms?
So there's actually two changes. One is the first one that you talked about, which was just unpublished works. So a lot of them will have known authors, the Henry Lawson letters, for example. But the other change, which was a very clever one introduced, I will say, give a lot of credit to the government and the public servants who worked on it, who came up with this plan. Basically, there's a group of materials in our collections that you just don't know who the copyright owner is. And in fact, in some collections, it is probably the majority, about 70% of the collection. If you think about the fact that copyright covers not just, sort of the big works of literature and the big movies, but, every single document written by every corporate person ever, and the term of copyright, and the copyright owner of that material by default is generally the person who wrote it, like the actual person who wrote the copyright material is what determines how long the copyright lasts. And once you start thinking about every letter, every diary entry, every shopping list, every recipe that's, being captured somewhere, you realise very quickly that the majority of copyright works, you can lose copyright owner very easily. And they're called orphan works because copyright basically is written on the assumption that if you can't use it legally under an exception, you can at least go get permission. But for these works, you just can't get permission. It's impossible. And so they become locked in this in no man's land where if you can't use them under one of the exceptions in the Act and if they're not in the public domain, then they just can't be used forever. And to make it even worse, because copyright term depends on the life of the author, you can't work out when they fall in the public domain. So they're potentially locked for a very long time, if not perpetually, in no man's land, unusable.
Now, I understand that Cook's carrot marmalade recipe was a part of his attack on scurvy. Can you tell me a bit more about it?
Yes, our understanding is that it's actually probably not really Captain Cook's recipe. It was in his diaries, which are held at the National Library in a very fancy strong room in the centre of the library. But it was given to him by somebody else. So somebody else's recipe, but in his collection. And he did use it in his efforts to battle scurvy. the main thing I can say about it is, as part of our campaign to get this changed, we encourage people to bake these recipes, to actually make them and, you know, try them out. We did try to make Captain Cook's carrot marmalade recipe, and I will say it didn't turn out the best. I'm not sure if there's something different about carrots in those days, or if we have different expectations of marmalade, or even just the equipment, but it pretty much turned out a sludge for us.
Oh, look, I'd be nonetheless very happy to receive a jar, and I'll share. I promise I'll share it with the entire Late Night Live team. We all suffer from scurvy here. We do. The ABC just doesn't look after our diet. Tell me about some other tidbits that caught your fancy.
Well, my personal favourite thing that's falling in the public domain is the old war advertisements and posters. You think about all those advertisements, support our troops, buy war bonds, all those kind of things. They don't have any authors attributed. Like, they don't have a signature on them. You know, they're artworks, so somebody drew them. But they don't have any copyright information about them all basically. So they were one of the biggest collections of orphan works. And the changes mean that anything before 1949 that's an orphan work will now be in the public domain, which means everything from the war pretty much goes in. And you think of all those wonderful things like Rosie the Riveter, though obviously that one's an American thing and probably quite well known. But there's equally beautiful things, posters and advertisements that now Australians can use to make new works or to tell people about the war or to, make a funny gif, whatever you like. It's there for you now. It's great.
Can we steam open Henry Lawson's letters?
Well, yes, we definitely can now. Obviously, his published materials have been in the public domain for a while because of the law, set that up okay. But it's now his letters and his diaries, and some of them are hilarious. He apparently had a habit of writing deliberately comical entries for people, in autograph books and things like that. And so a lot of them now are falling in the public domain. It's things like, there's something along the lines of, I get drunk because I'm unhappy, and then I'm unhappy so I get drunk.
It makes all sorts of sense to me, I think.
Yes.
Who might make use of this, this plethora of material?
Well, hopefully everybody. That's the beauty of the public domain. But the people who are most interested in getting this material out are obviously historians. It's wonderful for them. Teachers who want materials to use and show with their students. Family historians are trying to solve the mysteries of, their own past. But also probably the biggest group to benefit is creators. So people who want to create new works often, build on the past. You think of, Shakespeare using other people's plays, Disney using fairy tales. And all of a sudden a huge lot more material will now be available for people to use. There was a great incident in Adelaide where an artist, Peter Drew, found old mug shots that were at that time covered by copyright but would now be in the public domain. And he turned them into wanted posters all over Adelaide. And it's just a beautiful project that really brings out the history and brings it to everybody today.
RN, Ellie Nell. We're talking about changes to copyright law, Australian history now in the public domain, with Jessica Coates, who was the St. Joan in this battle, policy advisor with the Australian Library's Copyright Committee in Canberra. You mentioned Disney and dispatches. Let us now address the USA, because I know that Mickey comes into the story. A similar windfall of works under copyright have entered the public domain, but the circumstances for their release are different. Tell us how.
So essentially, coincidentally on the same date, the US also had a whole lot of material fall into the public domain, not because they'd changed their law, but because changes that happened 20 years ago were finally coming to an end. So essentially in 1998, the US passed some very big changes of law to their Copyright Act, mainly designed to update it for the internet. But one of the things that did was add 20 extra years of copyright to works that are already in copyright. It was called the Sonny Bono Act because Sonny Bono was the person who advocated for it. And this was fought against very strongly. If you think of the fact that copyright was already the life of the author plus 50 years at the time. So it was already 50 years after you died, your copyright still lasted. And they were adding an extra 20 years onto that in a way that basically wouldn't really encourage people to make new work. There was no real evidence that, you know, people thought when they were making a work, oh, life plus 50 isn't enough. Oh, but life plus 70, that will be enough.
Yeah.
It was more about protecting existing works from very famous people like Mickey Mouse and making sure they didn't fall into the public domain. And the result was that nothing fell in the public domain for 20 years in America. We've actually done the same thing in Australia.
Tell me some of the tidbits that are now available in the US.
It is a pretty amazing thing because of the complexity of how US law works. The date is 1923 where everything's falling in, and you have Agatha Christie works, and you have works by Noel Coward. You have a lot of the most famous material in the world really are changing in the US. Now, whether these things change in Australia is a totally different matter, but it's still very important for Australian creators because the US really is a very great hub of material, and the fact that they're more readily available there and in that market will really help us to get access to them too.
I understand I am now free to remake Cecil B. DeMille's original The Ten Commandments, and I can post it on YouTube.
If you make it in the US. I actually think that one might be in public domain in Australia too. But yes, the YouTube is based in the US, so it uses US copyright law. So essentially, yes, you would be able to, and it would be wonderful to see.
So, just because it's copyright-free in the US doesn't necessarily mean apply here?
No, not unfortunately, because sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Copyright term, you determine it based on where you are. So essentially, if I'm making a film in Australia, then I look at what the copyright, whether things that are in the public domain in Australia. It would just be too hard otherwise if you had to know the copyright rules of Burkina Faso before you could use any material from Burkina Faso. But that isn't necessarily a bad thing. There's some materials that have been in the public domain in Australia for longer than they have been in the US. And it just depends on the quirks of copyright law, unfortunately.
Get quite maddeningly complex. Suddenly, I'm thinking, say, of The Great Gatsby, American novel, remade as an allegedly Australian film by, in Sydney. I mean, it's not simple.
Yes, it's hardest probably for the filmmakers and people wanting to use films, because it's not just about The Great Gatsby. It's also about the script and the film footage and the sound that's been recorded and the lyrics of the sound and every piece of artwork you see in the background. In theory, if you wanted to work out if that film was in the public domain, you would have to work out when the person who created every single piece of that material died, which is why libraries and archives have hard jobs. The National Film and Sound Archives has one of the hardest jobs in Australia, I always say.
Now, of course, this opens the possibility of very tacky commercial exploitation of revered cultural works.
Yes, and that has been in the past a big concern. There was definitely a period when I would say even our libraries, archives and museums community tended to be a little bit protectionist, wanting to protect the veracity of the original works. But I think that has changed a lot in the last 20 years, as we've all been able to do a lot more of creating and publishing material ourselves. You know, once upon a time, you could do things in a bedroom and nobody ever knew about it. Now you can make it available to so much more, and we can all see the richness of creativity more. And I think we're more comfortable with that. We've started to realise that the original work isn't harmed. You know, you can make 10 things that I hate about you, and Shakespeare's Taming the Shrew is still there in its original form, and anybody can use it in that form. And 10 Things I Hate About You is just something else that is added, a new thing that builds on it.
Jessica, will we be able to delve into availabilities on, say, Trove?
Yes, that was going to be my big plug. This material is scattered throughout Australia and Australia's libraries and archives and museums. So if you want to find out about some things, you never know where you'll find it. But the best place to start is Trove. We are so lucky to have it. This centralised access point for the digital collections of most of our libraries and archives. It's really wonderful.
Blessings upon you, Jessica Coates. In fact, I'm going to give you the first koala stamp for the year. Jessica Coates, Copyright Law and Policy Advisor, Australian Libraries Copyright Committee.